This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. What became Crownsville Hospital Center started as farmland in Anne Arundel County, and then, after the state bought the land in 1910, was known as the Hospital for the Negro Insane of Maryland. Its patients, or inmates, included not only the mentally ill, but also blacks with mental disabilities, epilepsy, or syphilis. Historians have chronicled grim conditions during Crownsville's first five decades. Janice Hayes Williams, a local historian who's looked carefully at death records from Crownsville, described the state hospital on WIPR's The Signal in 2012.
So this was the place you did not want to go. This was the place where you were sent when nobody else wanted you. And this was the place that you went when there was nowhere else to go.
Crownsville was not integrated until the 1960s. At its most crowded, in the mid-1950s, about 2,700 black inmates lived at Crownsville, double what it had been built for. Over the years, hundreds of inmates died there, and many were buried in its little cemetery. Recently, a new set of eyes have been examining those graves. The Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society at Howard Community College wanted to understand what Crownsville can teach us today about the concept of separate but equal. And with us to talk about what they found are two students, Jonathan Schuster, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Alice Joy Thomas, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us is their advisor, Dr. Laura Cripps, Chair of Social and Cultural Sciences and Associate Professor of Anthropology at Howard Community College. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Cripps, you first suggested to the students that they should investigate the history of people who lived at Crownsville. Why?
Well, I've been aware of the site at Crownsville, and when the students raised the issue of the idea of separate but equal and investigating that concept today, it struck me that this might be one avenue of research. And so they were very quick to find a letter from the American Civil Liberties Union to former Governor O'Malley requesting that more be done to share information about the site, to disseminate the experiences of the people that lived at the site. When they got together and looked at the potential growth that they could experience and the potential impact they could have upon the community by researching the lives of the people who were here, they decided that that would be the topic for them.
Jonathan, you're from Howard County. Had you heard of Crownsville Hospital?
I had never heard of Crownsville before coming in contact with it through Phi Theta Kappa. This was my first exposure to it. I think what struck me first was this whole concept of separate but equal, that this was an institution founded on the idea of separating people based on their race. Before this, other institutions in and out of Maryland were actually paying other mental institutions to take the African-American patients from their institutions and to separate them out.
And Alice Joy, first of all, had you heard about Crownsville before
no,
this
I had
project?
Not.
And what was your first point of getting into it? What thoughts did you have as you started this project?
Well, I originally had found it very interesting because I didn't know that there were hospitals like that. Like, I knew that there was mental hospitals, like, back then, but I had never known that there were ones for specific races. So I think that was what struck me the most. Like, I thought it was horrible that they were putting them there. And then when I had found out that they were putting people there who weren't necessarily mentally ill, that really...
Who had other issues but not mental illness.
Well, you didn't even necessarily have to have an issue. Some people had children out of wedlock or just were homeless, and they would be put in the hospital as well.
Jonathan, tell us about the cemetery.
Okay, so the cemetery sits to the west of the hospital. It's split by 97.
Interstate 97.
Correct. So largely abandoned now, restricted to the public
access.
The
hospital, I should say, closed in 2004.
It did. Mm-hmm. But even before that, operations had very much been scaled down since the mid-90s. Estimated that there are approximately 2,000 to 3,000 people buried there. But we only have 400 grave markers, which makes this interesting.
Only 400 graves are marked.
Correct. And what we mean by marked in this case is typically a small concrete block stamped with a series of digits.
And I think it's important to say that that's what remains at the moment. There may well have been other grave markers which have since been overgrown or come underground because of sedimentation. And it is protected from regular visitation behind a padlock gate. But there are different groups from the community who do go in and now try to clean back and maintain the area. And you know, I think it's just not necessarily abandoned as such, but it's protected and it's behind a gated enclosure. And the real issue is that there are a number of graves there with markers that aren't present. And of the markers that are, they're mostly a number as opposed to a name. Yeah. And that's really where the students got their idea for their project.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kast, speaking with Laura Cripps, Chair of Social and Cultural Sciences at Howard Community College. And also here are two students, Jonathan Schuster and Alice Joy Thomas, who are involved in the project. So how did you go about learning more about the men and women at Crownsville?
So we used the census records as our kind of our jumping off point. We were fortunate enough to be given a grant from Ancestry.com, which allowed us the opportunity to really efficiently pour through a huge amount of census records, specifically the 1940 census, because it's the newest census available, because they don't become available until 72 years after they're completed. And so what we did with that is we looked and we said, who is at Crownsville in 1940? And we can see that very clearly. There are pages and pages of census sheets of just people who are at Crownsville. And with that,
so we're not talking about who is buried there. You're talking about
correct. Who was
the
living
census.
There?
Who was living,
who was
at
living there as of 1940? Mm-hmm. These people are classified as inmates on that census, and using this information, we can trace forwards and backwards from this. Once we've established this starting point, and we can use that information to try to trace and tell their life story in some way.
Alice Joy, is there a particular person you uncovered whose story speaks to you most?
There was one woman that I uncovered, Mrs. Pryor, and she was on the 1920, 1930, and 1940 census, which means she had been at Crownsville for 30 years. And on the census, you can find what she did at Crownsville, like her job, and then you can find usually their parents' occupation too. So on hers, she was one of the people who actually had a grave marker as well. So you could see what year she was born, what year she died, and for a lot of people, you can't find that. You just have their name, and then you can't trace them. So for her in specific, there was a whole bunch of things and factors that went into finding who she was specifically. Because a lot of these people are just names, and you don't know their story. You don't know how long they were at Crownsville, where they died, where they were buried.
Jonathan, is there somebody that whom you researched who kind of came alive for you?
This is where the research process gets interesting. Because you're looking at this census, and you just see a name, and you see a place. But when you can start to connect these other pieces together, it becomes very engaging. So I found Mr. Adams, and he's born right here in Baltimore in about 1898, I believe. We can see that he is from a family of five. His father is a stevedore in the Baltimore Harbor, loading and unloading cargo ships. We see him in 1910 on the census. We see that he's a student still here in Baltimore, Cathedral Street. 1917, we have his draft registration card. So you start to see this tapestry emerge of this person. By 1920, we kind of lose track of him for a little bit. He doesn't show up on that census. So I think there raises the question, was he serving at this time, or where did he go for that period? He appears again on the 1930 census at Crownsville. We don't really know why he's at Crownsville. But from the other research we've done, the other people we've found, it's my belief that there's the possibility here of a lot of kind of undiagnosed PTSD. We see a lot of individuals who served in World War I and World War II kind of mysteriously appearing at Crownsville shortly after returning to the States. This is not something that's been talked about and not something that's been researched, but I think there's definitely the potential here for some connection between these two things.
And I think this is what the students found. They started by being intrigued by this cemetery and the fact that there were individuals who were buried without marker and maybe buried and lost to public memory in that way. And they realized very quickly that the work of Janice Hayes Williams has already tried to identify some of these. And it can be very difficult because you see members of the public who have been given back to their families upon their death and buried elsewhere. And then you have the names that seem to disappear into the ether, and they may be individuals at Crownsville. But very quickly, the work of Alice and of Jonathan and of our other members of the organization on campus, They started to research these individuals and found veterans and found individuals with children at the site, children below the age of 8, below the age of 10, below the age of 18, who were present. And they started to get ideas about their family structure, the fact that their grandparents or their parents came from Baltimore, the jobs they did, mm-hmm. maybe some of the speculative reasons why they were there. And they wanted to undertake a project and communicate the value of these people's lives so that a memory of their value in life was there to replace a lack of memory of their value in death. And I think that's what has been brought from this project on campus. Alice has had some great dialogues about race. This concept of race, which is biologically now proven to not exist, but socially is such an important construct that still is an issue today with issues such as Ferguson and so on. It can be really difficult to find a vehicle for students to talk about these things on campus. But this project really provided that and gave great opportunity to recognize the lives of individuals who are at Crownsville who otherwise have been lost to public memory.
Well, I appreciate your telling us about it. Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thank you.
Laura Cripps is chair of social and cultural sciences and associate professor of anthropology at Howard Community College. Jonathan Schuster and Alice Joy Thomas are in their second year of study at the community college. They're both members of the Phi Theta Kappa Honor Society there. We have more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, including a piece from Maryland Morning's Frames of Mind mental health series about Crownsville and a piece by The Signal. And the letter the ACLU wrote the governor 2 years ago asking the state to document Crownsville's history. More of this interview there, too. I'm Sheila Cass. There's much more ahead on Maryland Morning. Stay with us on 88.1.